So this lecture is, this is lecture 2 in chapter 20. And we're going to start off by talking about problems and solutions in cloning and expressing eukaryotic genes. So what we've learned so far is that we've learned how to clone a eukaryotic gene, you know, that's a human gene, into a prokaryotic organism, a bacteria. But, and it's, you know, I just want you to sort of, for a minute, just think about this. This is, you know, if Darwin, you know, Darwin's birthday is coming up soon. If Darwin were living today, he'd be so excited by this because what it says is it shows how life is all linked together. The fact that a little prokaryote can actually take the DNA from a eukaryote and manufacture the same protein is pretty darned amazing. So sometimes we just sort of don't even think about that, but all life is linked together. We use the same process pretty much for protein synthesis, the same code. Very cool. So we learned in chapter 18 and 19 that both prokaryotes and eukaryotes control gene expression. However, they do it slightly differently. Okay, you learned about the operon, the lac operon, the trip operon, repressible and inducible operons for prokaryotes. And then we just sort of had a brief view yesterday of what goes on in eukaryotic control of gene expression. And we didn't get into any of the details, really. We just sort of took a big conceptual broad brush view of that. But one of the things we can say is they certainly use different promoters. They have different control sequences. And so there's a problem, because if you're going to stick eukaryotic gene into a prokaryote, you got to deal with this stuff. So we overcome this by using a plasmid that has a prokaryotic promoter just upstream of the restriction site where you're going to insert the eukaryotic gene. Okay? And what we call this plasmid is we call it an expression vector, because it's going to express the protein from the eukaryote. Okay? And the promoter and everything will ensure that the eukaryotic gene is properly expressed. And you can actually see in my illustration here, and this is taken from a book that's not our book, and I really like the way they do it. And I've had these illustrations before where they're numbered sequentially, and they kind of do a really nice job of showing you what happens. And so if we read the first, the thing that's labeled number one, it says, an expression vector, which is what we're showing here, includes the appropriate sequences for transcription and translation in the host cell. And you can see there is a promoter, which is that's from the actual prokaryote. It's yellow. And then you've got what's called a ribosome binding sequence. And then you've got the place where you're going to actually do the insertion. And you'll see that there is a restriction enzyme called BAMH1, and that's, you know, there's more than 100 restriction enzymes, and this is just one of them. And so biotechnologists will use different restriction enzymes, so they just happen to use BAMH1 for this, and that's where you're going to actually insert the human DNA. And then you've got a terminator in red here. And then you'll see next in purple a foreign gene. This would be like, let's say, for example, let's say you want to clone in the insulin gene from humans. So let's just say this is the insulin gene to produce human insulin. And so you insert it. Now remember, it was removed from humans using the same restriction enzyme. So it has the same sticky ends that will be created when you use the BAMH1 with the expression vector. And so then it can insert itself right in there, because it just fits right in, and now you're ready to go. And then you take that expression vector, which is really a plasmid, and you make sure that it gets inserted into an E. coli, which is, you know, just a common bacteria. And now you can see it's good to go, and it can produce messenger RNA, and then the messenger RNA, which has the code for producing the insulin protein, and then you produce insulin. And you, of course, when you do this, they do it in huge vats, billions and billions of E. coli bacteria, which are just cranking out insulin all the time. And then what they do is they end up isolating the the protein from all the other stuff, and then they bottle it in little bottles, and they sell it for a lot of money, and they make that really is how this billion-dollar biotech industry got started. And you know, that's where Genentech, which is just, you know, like an hour north of here in San Francisco, that's what they do, and that's how they became a billion-dollar industry, by doing that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not going into all the details here, but they've tweaked all that stuff so it works. So basically what they do is the people who are doing this work, the biotechnologists, they figured out where to put starts and stops and all the everything you need to make it work. You know, and it's just a matter of playing around with the system until you... That's why it's called bioengineering, you know, right? Because you're kind of like an engineer. You take a system and you try to figure out how to make it work. Yeah. Yeah, well, remember, many bacteria can pretty much make all the amino acids from scratch, okay? Some of them can make most of them from scratch and need some. It just depends. And I'm not sure if, you know, this E. coli makes them all or whether it's, you know, it just depends. You know, my hunch would be they probably have a species of, or a sub, you know, type of E. coli that presumably makes all the amino acids, so it's, they don't have to supply any. It'd be cheaper. You just give it raw ingredients and let it do all the work. Okay, so in our next slide, I raise a problem that maybe you didn't think about. But eukaryotic DNA, if you remember, has long non-coding sections. We call these introns. Remember this? And because prokaryotes do not have to deal with introns, they don't have the normal RNA splicing enzymes. Remember spliceosomes and all that stuff, to remove these non-coding regions. So they've got a problem. So the solution to this problem has been to make artificial genes. And these artificial genes actually lack introns so that the prokaryotes don't have a problem here. So here's how they do it. It's very clever. What the scientists do is they will allow, like you, let's say, they have to use a person, right? They find a person or they get cells from a person and they allow the cells to process messenger RNA, okay? So they, let's say, the cell is going to produce insulin. So it basically will create, they'll read the code, make what we call pre-messenger RNA, then that pre-messenger RNA will be manipulated, removing the introns, and this is just all done naturally, right? This is what our cells do all the time. And then that piece of messenger RNA, which is all the introns removed, that leaves the nucleus, and now you've got a really nice sequence of messenger RNA that's the way you want it. And what they do is they take that, and then they use reverse transcriptase on that piece of messenger RNA. And remember, reverse transcriptase takes messenger RNA and makes DNA. And that's exactly what happens. And you can see in the illustration here that the messenger RNA, which is colored in pink, will now create a piece of DNA that's complementary to it. And what they do is they call this DNA complementary DNA, or cDNA. And whenever you see this term, cDNA or complementary DNA, it's eukaryotic DNA that was, you know, originally had introns. The introns were removed, messenger RNA was made, and then DNA was made from that messenger RNA. So it's basically a chunk of DNA with all the introns removed. And what's nice about that is the DNA that's added into the plasmid, or the expression vector, however you want to call it. And so now you don't have the problem of, you know, what does a prokaryote do with introns? Well, it doesn't have to worry about it because there are no introns. Very clever. Another problem is that eukaryotic proteins, which are, you know, so when we make proteins, they're often modified after translation. I haven't really talked about this, but oftentimes carbohydrate groups or lipid groups are added to the protein. Well, that's a problem because prokaryotes can't do this. So what's the solution? Well, what they do is oftentimes, depending on, you know, what kind of proteins they're making, they won't even use bacteria. They'll use yeast to actually make the proteins. And the reason why they use yeast, why do you think they use yeast? What would you suspect? Why would you use yeast instead of bacteria? What advantage might yeast have? How are yeast different than bacteria? Yeah. They're eukaryotes, exactly. And because they're eukaryotes, they have most of the genetic machinery that's needed. And another thing is they're still single cell. So you kind of get the advantage of the single cell aspect, which means it's very easy to culture them, raise them, and all so forth. But they're eukaryotes, so they understand, you know, quote unquote, what to do with these proteins. And they also divide rapidly, so there's fast turnaround time and so forth. And another thing that I haven't talked about is they are one of the few eukaryotes that actually has plasmids. So that's helpful as well. Now, genomic libraries are discussed in your book, and it's a way to store a lot of human DNA. And so the way they do it, and this from your book, this what's pictured here is called a shotgun approach. It's from figure 20.3 in your book. And what you do is you just add restriction enzymes and chop up the DNA into lots of little pieces. You don't target any particular gene. So you're not like going, I'm going to go in and get the insulin gene. You don't care. You just get, just chop the DNA up into lots of pieces. And then each of those fragments of DNA is cloned into a plasmid. And then they're kept separate from one another. And so you've got all the little pieces of DNA in a lot of different bacteria, and they're just stored for use if you need them. So, for example, and this is called a genomic library, and you can store them for later use. And so in the illustration right below the text here, you'll see a piece of foreign DNA that could be DNA from humans, and it's chopped up into a lot of different pieces, kind of randomly. Throw in a restriction enzyme, you get a bunch of pieces, and they're colored here, yellow, brown, red, blue. And then you, each of those is individually inserted into a different a plasmid, and or into a bacterial chromosome, actually. And then they're cloned and just left on a petri dish or however they store them. I'm not exactly sure how they store them, I think. Or that you can even do the same thing and put them in phages. You can have phage libraries as well. And then they can be used for whatever you need to do, any kind of research you need to do. You go in and you find the particular segment you need and you make more of it or do whatever you need to do. Because it's kind of like the idea is here, divide and conquer. You want to just make it into little pieces and then store it for when you need to use it for research. Now, this is exciting, okay? This I'm going to talk about how to amplify DNA. And the way it's done is through a process called the polymerase chain reaction. And if let's just break the word down. What is a polymer? A polymer. What does polymer mean? What does poly mean? Many. And polymer is many segments, right? What is ACE? Whenever you see ACE, what does that mean? Enzyme. What's a chain reaction? When you think chain reaction, what do you think? What? Okay, a series of events that each cause each other. But what happens in a chain reaction? You know, like, literally what happens in a chain reaction? Yeah. Okay, but there's another key thing in chain reactions, really key. Like when you talk about a nuclear chain reaction, you know, right? What's going on? It gets bigger. So one thing produces two, two produces four, four produces eight produces 16, and just, you know, bigger. That's what a chain reaction is, okay? Now, what is this? It's simply a method for making many copies of a piece of DNA, and it was discovered in 1983. Now, if you were to ask anybody out in the world of biotechnology today, what is the most important biotechnology technique that's been invented in the last 30 years, they would say this. This has this has revolutionized biotechnology. This is what's used when they, like if you ever watch CSI and they, you know, want to do some kind of analysis, they need, like, let's say there was a murder and the suspect, you can see that there's a blood trail to where the car was, and you figure, oh, that's the blood of the suspect. So they take a little bit of blood and they can get some of the DNA from the blood. But the problem is, it's just a little bit of blood, which is a little bit of DNA, not enough DNA to really do anything with. So what are you going to do? Well, what you're going to do is you need to amplify certain segments of the DNA so you can study, figure out, you know, if the person is, you know, if the suspect's blood matches the blood here that you found at the crime scene. But you need a way to amplify little segments of the DNA. That's what you're able to do here. And it's used in all other, I mean, this is just one area that's used in. So the guy that discovered this was actually from the Bay Area. His name is Kerry Mullis. And what happens when you discover something really significant in science? What usually happens to you eventually? What happens? Yeah, but in this case, they didn't, because they immediately recognized, oh my gosh, this is an amazing technique. So what are they going to do? They're going to give him the Nobel Prize, and he sure enough won the Nobel Prize. Now, let me just tell you something. This guy's kind of a freak, okay? He's brilliant. He's amazingly smart, but he is definitely not a role model for high school kids. However, I think it's just fun because he is so weird to tell you a little bit about him. So I'm going to click on my link here, and it's going to take you to the book that he wrote about his life called Dancing Naked in the Mind Field. And so there is a, let's get a close-up of the cover of his book, so you'll see what Kerry Mullis looks like. And so here's, let me see, it's coming up here. Okay, there he is. Okay, there he is with his surfboard. And, you know, Nobel Prize-winning scientist. He won the Nobel Prize in chemistry. And he's a surfer dude. And, but what's even more amazing is, check it. I just got to read this to you because it just cracks me up. By the way, if anyone's interested, I did have the library purchase this book. So if you just find this guy, I got to read about this guy. The book is in the school library. I probably shouldn't have it there, but I just think it's funny. Okay, so let me read what it's, the Amazon review says. Kerry Mullis won the Nobel Prize for his invention of the polymerase chain reaction, a chemical procedure that allows scientists to see the structures of the molecules of genes. Mullis is no shy, socially inept bench chemist, though. On the contrary, he has led as big and full a life as possible, opening himself to experiences like hallucinogenic drugs, surfing, casually handling dangerous chemicals, and taking shots at the sacred cows of science. Dancing Naked in the Minefield is Mullis' own chronicle of his adventures, from wooing countless women to possibly being abducted by aliens. Seriously, I think he thinks he was abducted by aliens. And it's a funny, shocking tale indeed. This man certainly doesn't suffer from lack of self-esteem, and yet you might want him along on a trip to the astral plane, say, or a tour of the human genome. Mullis is a fascinating character, and his autobiography will put to rest forever the stereotype of scientists as skeptical nerd. So anyhow, there you go. If you want to read about him, you can go to the library and get his book out of the library. Kerry Mullis. So anyhow, he is very smart. But he is very strange. Okay, so let me tell you about the polymerase chain reaction. Here's what you need. First of all, you need a piece of DNA. We call this the targeted sequence. And so when the targeted sequence can be any length. It can be 100 base pairs. It can be 300 base pairs. It can be 1,000 base pairs. It's just a section of the DNA that you want. But you've got to decide, this is what I want. Okay? Number two. What you need in order to do this process, oh, and by the way, I just want to sort of make you aware of how scientists make great discoveries. Kerry Mullis wasn't sitting in his lab in Berkeley thinking about this and came up with PCR. He was actually on a Friday evening driving with his girlfriend up to Mendocino to spend the weekend in Mendocino, which is up north of Marin County. It's on the coast. So he's just driving up, you know, it's probably like 7:30 at night, driving along, you know, up on 101 or something. And then he was thinking about what he was doing in his lab, and then the idea just popped up in his brain, like, oh, if you did this and this and this, you could amplify DNA. You could make like a million copies or a billion copies of this little chunk of DNA within about 2 hours. Whoa, cool idea. And so he just came up with the idea of driving up to Mendocino. And one of the things he realized is that if he was going to be able to do this, he was going to need to have a special kind of DNA polymerase. Because as we all know, in order to make messenger RNA, or make another piece of DNA, excuse me, you need DNA polymerase. But the problem is, you need to take the DNA double helix and you need to unwind it. In order to unwind it and cause it to come apart, you need to heat the DNA, which the temperature works out to be about 95 degrees. Well, what's the problem with heating the DNA to 95 degrees? What's that? It will denature the DNA polymerase, because DNA polymerase is a protein, it's an enzyme, and enzymes denature if you heat them. So he said, ah, darn, I'm going to have to find a DNA polymerase that can withstand high temperatures. So you know what he realized? Is, hey, let's let natural selection do the work for me. I'm just going to go somewhere in the world where organisms live in a very, very hot environment. So natural selection will have helped create a DNA polymerase that can withstand really high temperatures, because every organism has to be able to has to have DNA polymerase. Every organism has to have it. So what do you do? He goes out to these hot springs, or they ended up realizing you just need to go to these hot springs in Yellowstone National Park, and you need to find a bacteria that's been living there, and you know that the DNA polymerase from those bacteria can withstand very high temperatures. And that's exactly what they did. And so they actually isolated the DNA polymerase from the organism called Thermus aquaticus. And they actually have a special name for that DNA polymerase. It's called TAC polymerase. Why do you think it's called TAC polymerase? What? Exactly. The T comes from Thermus and the AQ comes from aquaticus. And that's what it is. Yeah. Because in order to cause the DNA double helix to separate, you have to heat it up. Otherwise, it won't come apart. And you need to go up to about 95 degrees. And if you go up to 95 degrees, normal DNA polymerase, your DNA polymerase would denature. And then it wouldn't function. Yeah, these guys are fine, the Thermus aquaticus. So let me just let you guys don't get confused by this. Because when I first learned this, no one really explained it to me, and I got a little confused. Because I thought TAC polymerase was a different kind of polymerase. It isn't. It's just DNA polymerase that comes from Thermus aquaticus. And the only thing that's special about it is it can withstand really high temperatures. Otherwise, it's just like all other DNA polymerase. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, 95 degrees Celsius. Yeah, okay. Yeah. A little higher than our temperature. Okay. You also need DNA primers. And primers are short little segments. Now, you remember when you create DNA, right? You need little primers. And they normally use RNA primers. But they were able to rig this so you could use DNA primers, which is really nice, because if you use DNA primers, you don't have to go in and remove the RNA and, you know, put DNA there. It's just, you just start with DNA primers and you're good to go. So you need primers to get it started. And so what you do is you decide, okay, I want this 500 base pair section of DNA amplified. And so then you find the primers are anywhere between like 10 to 20, you know, roughly, let's say 15 to 20 base pairs long. It could be up to 25. And you find that sequence on one side of where your targeted DNA is, and then the sequence on the other side. You know, and so what you've got is now you got your two primers and you're good to go. And it's like, it's kind of like a parenthesis. It says, we're only going to copy this section right here. Okay? And by the way, there are companies all over the world now that will create primers. So what you do is, if you're a scientist, you decide where in the DNA you want to amplify a piece, and you make sure you know the sequence right before on either side of it, you know, maybe 25 base pairs. And you just email the company. And this is what I did, I think, 5 years ago at Cold Spring Harbor when I was there for 3 weeks. We were given a budget, and we were allowed to do any research we wanted. So my partners and I decided we wanted to amplify several pieces of DNA from this plant. And so we went into the literature, and we found where the gene was, and we found what the sequence was on either side of the gene. We could just look that up. Someone had already, you know, sequenced the whole thing. And we just emailed the company, and we said, we want primers that have ATT, CCGG, whatever we wanted, on in this other, the other primer's different. And we want these two primers, and we just sent in an order, and 2 days later, by UPS, there was a little package, and it had our primers. So we're ready to go. Okay? It's very quick. It's very cool. It's, I mean, this is big business now. Big business. So, like I said, they're complementary pieces of DNA that go on either end of the targeted sequence. You also need the four nucleotides because you need raw material to make your, you know, your DNA. And so you need ATP, CTP, GTP, and TTP. And this is the raw material. So on my next slide, this kind of lays the whole thing out. So let me just kind of walk you through it. Up here at the top, there's your piece of DNA that you want. And in blue is your targeted sequence. That's what you actually want to amplify. You need DNA polymerase, the special kind from Thermus aquaticus. You need two primers, and you need the four nucleotides. And here's the process. The first thing you do is you need to separate the DNA strands. And the way to do that is you heat it up to about 95 degrees Celsius, and it will open up. Now what you do is you cool this, not too cold because you don't want the DNA to come together, but you want to cool it enough so that the primers will stick. And we call causing the primers to stick to the DNA, there's a special technical term. It's called annealing. So you anneal the primers by cooling it down, and now the primers will anneal. Then you warm it up a little bit more, so you've gone from a high temperature to like from like 95 to like maybe 65, then you or 50, somewhere around there. Then you heat it up a little bit more to get the DNA polymerase to act, to work, and that's maybe around 70 something. And then now you've got two pieces of DNA where you originally had one. Then you do that again. You heat it up, it opens up, you cool it down, you anneal the primers. Then you warm it up a little bit, the DNA polymerase extends it, and so forth, and now you've got four. And then four goes to eight, and so on and so forth. And this is how it works, okay? Now, let me ask you this question. If you are going to heat something up and cool it down, you're going to think about that. You're going to need to do that a whole bunch of times, again and again. So what Mullis realized is he's going to have to do this, and then there were, obviously, once he came up with this idea, companies got into this, and they said, oh, my goodness, we need to create a machine that will automate this, that will raise the temperature, cool it down, raise it, and we can adjust how long it's at that temperature and when it goes down. And so they've invented these machines. They're very expensive. They're called thermocyclers. You get it? Thermocycler. So it just goes through different temperature regimes, and it does the same thing over and over and over again. Now, I want to show you this because this is very cool. It's a PCR animation, and this animation will kind of demonstrate for you. Okay, I gotta click this. Oops, go back. Sorry. So let me click on the PCR animation. Okay. So this is a really wonderful animation that kind of walks through how it works. So this is on the DNA Learning Center site. So we start off, you can see very high temperatures, 95 degrees Celsius, not Fahrenheit. You denature the DNA. There's your region of interest. It comes apart. Now you take it down to 50 to 65 degrees Celsius. You anneal the primers. In come the primers. You bring it up to 72 degrees, you extend the primers, there's DNA polymerase, and now it makes another piece of DNA. You go to cycle two, you denature the DNA at 95 degrees, you anneal the primers at 50 to 65 degrees, you extend the primers at 72 degrees, and now you've got four. And you go to the third cycle, and you go through the whole thing, you denature, you anneal, you extend. So it's basically denature, anneal, extend, and it just keeps doing that over and over again, and you're doubling every time. And you can go to the fifth cycle and so forth. Now, on this last slide, it's very cool. This is a graph. I just want to show you how dramatic it is. Watch what happens. I'm going to go through about 30 cycles and watch how this goes. It's amazing. Cycle one, you get two DNA copies. What we want to actually look at is the target copies. Because you get copies of the DNA, but they've extended too far. What you want is just that little section, and that's the target copy. So after three cycles, you've got two target copies. After four cycles, you've got eight target copies. After five cycles, you get 22. But you can see that the DNA copies and the target basically converge on one another. And we'll just crank it up here to about 20, get up to 20 cycles. So at 20 cycles, we've got a million target copies. That's a million pieces of the same piece of DNA. Watch this. This is amazing. I'll take it up to 30 cycles. When I get up to 30 cycles, I've got a billion target copies. So amazing. So within about 2 hours, this takes about 2 hours, 2 to 3 hours, you can go from one piece of DNA to a billion pieces of the same little targeted piece of DNA. It's amazing. And this is revolutionized biotechnology. It's very, very cool. Okay.